Good afternoon, everybody, or good evening. This is Patrick from the Poison Pen Bookstore in Scottsdale, Arizona, and we're here with another of our virtual events. And this afternoon, we have Rosalie Knecht with us. She's going to be talking about her brand new book, Vera Kelly, Lost and Found. And Rosalie very kindly signed some book plates here. And so we have some here, and I'll go ahead and put a link in the comments field if you'd like to purchase a copy of the book. And also, if you have questions for Rosalie or Barbara, go ahead and put them in, and Barbara will summon me back at some point, probably about 45 minutes into the hour, to ask any questions you might have. So Barbara, over to you.
Thank you very much, Patrick. I would like to say, one, it's a real pleasure to meet you, Rosalie. Thank you for joining us.
Likewise.
Two, I would like to say, I just absolutely love the cover design for these books. They're all similar. I don't have the other two to show you, but I really think that it's a brilliant design. Well, Rosalie, did you have any input into the covers?
I didn't. I just got out of the way, basically. Jacob Valla at Tin House designed the covers, and he did the first cover, which, you know, was sort of the template. And then they had the idea in-house to do this kind of paper doll thing where it's sort of the same face, the same, you know, same proportions, and then they just put different accessories and sunglasses and things like that on her. So that was, I can't claim any credit for any of that. Yeah.
Well, I think it's so eye-catching, and you know, it shows up really well in what are the JPEGs? I never remember the word. Not just book covers, but I think it looks very impressive online, and it makes you want to connect with Vera. So this is, in its way, an historical series, and this is book three three Vera Kellys. So I thought, since we haven't talked to Rosalie before, that it would be interesting to get some background on why she wrote them, because I think the first book starts in 1963, am I right?
Yeah, well, it has like a timeline from 57 to through 66, yeah.
Okay.
I had studied Argentina in college, and I had been there, and I was kind of interested in Argentine history, and there was this coup that happened in 1966. It was kind of a more farce than tragedy. It was like, it was kind of obvious that it was coming. It happened very smoothly. Nobody was really hurt. And it was kind of this like little, like, okay, we have a new government now kind of thing. And the new president after the coup was sort of an odd character. He was a military guy, but he was also very puritanical, very Catholic, and he was interested in, he had these sort of morality codes that he enforced, this very kind of, you know, he passed laws about how you had to keep the lights on in nightclubs, and your skirts couldn't be shorter than a certain length, and that kind of stuff. So it was an interesting period, I thought. And my interest was also coming from the other side. My maternal grandfather worked for the CIA. He analyzed Soviet radio propaganda broadcasts. So he wasn't, you know, he wasn't a spy. He was not in a clandestine capacity, but he worked with CIA. And I was interested in him, but like on a couple of levels, because he died in 1961. So I had never met him. And even my mom really kind of barely remembers him. So he really feels like this figure from like a distant era, even though he's just my own grandfather. And I was kind of interested in the idea of like, what is, you know, what's it like to be a spy or working for the CIA on the actual everyday kind of bureaucratic level, just to sort of grind day to day. And that's kind of where I started. And I was trying to think of, you know, what kind of a character makes a choice like this to kind of live in a way, because you're doing undercover work where you can't really have close personal connections, right? And you kind of have to feel comfortable maintaining a dual identity. And that's kind of where the character of Vera developed from, is the idea of, she's a person who's had to hide who she is anyway because she's gay, and she's developed a lot of defenses, and she doesn't get close to people easily anyway. So it doesn't feel like a big sacrifice to her, even though I think over the course of that book and then the later books, that sort of, she does begin to get a sense of like what she's giving up by living that way. And she does start to try to live in a different way. So it kind of starts with her. It says a little bit of backstory of her as a teenager, kind of growing up in the kind of affluent kind of square suburbs around DC in the 50s. And then it's kind of following her as she's coming of age kind of in New York in the 60s.
I looked up the first book, which is called Who is Vera Kelly? An excellent mm-hmm. title. Basically what it had to say is New York, 1962, Vera Kelly is struggling to make rent and blend into the underground gay scene in Greenwich Village. She's working night shifts at a radio station when her quick wits, sharp tongue, and technical skills get her noticed by a recruiter for the CIA. And then the next thing you know, she's in Argentina. So I think that's, New York, 1962, the gay scene was, it was still somewhat underground, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was very underground. And it was interesting doing research for this because, of course, the Stonewall riots happened in 1969, and that was a confrontation between people who were out at a gay bar in the village and the police one night that kind of, instead of, usually they would do these raids regularly, right? Like whenever they kind of wanted to cause a scene or beat some people up or extort money sometimes from bar owners, they would go do a raid. And usually they would kind of throw everybody out of the bar and everybody would just kind of melt into the night and that would be the end of it. But on this particular occasion in 1969, and this is just mentioned in passing in the book, it's not featured, but people just didn't go anywhere. They kind of stuck around. They kind of refused to be humiliated, and there was a confrontation with the police and a lot of, rocks were thrown, and it was kind of this galvanizing event for gay people in New York and kind of, across the country. But so 1962 is 7 years before that, that's not happening. And so it's kind of, for a long time at that point, there'd been kind of this, it's a bit of a wink, wink, nudge, nudge. It's like, right. It's you're not allowed to be out at a gay bar. You're not allowed to be doing that stuff, right? You're not allowed to be serving a gay clientele, but the cops know who those bars are. And the relationship is kind of, people who want to like run gay spaces tend to have to be extorted by the mob also. So they were sort of caught between like the mob and the police. And the system kind of had a certain equilibrium to it, except when things would come along and upset it, like the police commissioner is running for re-election and suddenly they're raiding all the bars, that kind of thing. So it was like both out in the open and also very precarious and kind of subject to the whims of, politicians and police and organized crime.
It really wasn't that different than Prohibition, if you think about it. Every time we try to legislate something like people's behavior, it has unexpected consequences. And, Prohibition is the reason that we got so much in the way of crime families, crime bosses, sure. Whatever it is, underground money, and the corruption was tremendous. And people died from drinking bathtub gin and, all kinds of things. And so what was intended to be a benefit to society actually was not. I think the same thing is true in regard to what Rosalie's just talked about. And not to be political, but I think we're going to see that happening around abortion that, I can remember when because I'm a child of I was born in 1940, so I can remember during my teenage years and so forth, abortions were illegal, there wasn't really contraception, and so having sex was an extremely dangerous proposition for a woman, for a girl, and lives could be ruined as a consequence of it. So I'm finding it really disturbing that we're going back to that. But on a lighter note, I have to tell you a great story about Buenos Aires, because my husband and I embarked in January of 2002. So it was after 9/11 and there was a lot of security going on, but we were sailing around, we're going to Antarctica, but we're sailing down South America, down the coast of South America. And so one of our stops is going to be Buenos Aires. And so, we've had a good time in Brazil, and we started in Rio, actually. So that was really fun, Copacabana. And then we were in Montevideo, and then as we're approaching Buenos Aires, and the day we're getting off, the captain comes on the ship, Horn, and he says, well, we're not going to be able to make our stop in Buenos Aires. And, he said, they're having a coup, they're having a war, and it's not safe for us to stop and let all of you go ashore. So, you know, much unhappiness and grumbling because, you know, people were all excited. I mean, we were going to see, you know, the tango and we were going to do all this great stuff. And so, you know, about 45 minutes went by and the captain reappears and he said, well, he said, we've done a deal. He said, they're going to stop the war for the day so that you can, no, I'm serious. We're going to stop the war for the day because we have all these tours arranged for you to go to the Pink Palace and, you know, to go to see the tango show. And I mean, in fact, there was a whole evening thing about the tango show that we were all going to. And it's just, it's, he didn't say this, but clearly it's so much money, you know, from a ship with maybe, I think it was about 900 people or something on board, the Argentinians thought, well, we'll just take a break from the hostilities. We'll promise not to shoot anybody. It'll all be fine.
Wow.
And you can come ashore. And indeed, they did have, you know, like a kind of security presence around, because there's a, you know, a big square in Argentina with the presidential palace and the cathedral and all that stuff. So anyway, they had it all done. So we all spent the day, and about 10 o'clock, we get back on the ship and as we're sailing away, we can hear gunfire starting up again in the background. And I thought, it was just so wonderful.
Well,
I've been back since to Buenos Aires, but nothing has ever made that original impression on me quite as much as that occasion. So, you know, I found your scenario in Who Is Vergilli entirely believable. That was great. So then you went on to write a second book for Vera in which, sorry, I've lost my place again. It's called, where is it? Vera Kelly Is Not a Mystery. There it is. Do you have copies of these you can show us? Because I don't.
I don't have them in this room. I did not think to bring them in here. It's my study, obviously, that I'm in, my private library.
Well, they basically are a variation on the cover. It really cool. But now Vera apparently has lost her job and is reluctantly gone. And she's also busted up with her girlfriend, both happening on the same day, which is pretty hard. And she's gone into business as a private detective, heartbroken and cash strapped. She takes a case that dredges up dark memories and attracts dangerous characters from across the Cold War landscape. So that's really kind of interesting. What is the what's the dark case that she takes up?
She's trying to find a missing kid, and the kid is to not give too much away, but the kid is missing because he's been taken into foster care and she can't find him. And the kid is actually the child of Dominican exiles, and it's, you know, and et cetera. And this was happening, so, and that, this one is set in 68, so this is 3 years after the United States invaded the Dominican Republic, so it's like a little bit about the aftermath of that and how chaotic that was, and that very complex relationship between the United States and the Dominican Republic.
Very true. There was a very nice quote attached to this. I did a little research. This winning literary page turner gives a strong sense of a smart, queer, and complex person navigating an unfriendly world. I thought that was a, you know, a very thoughtful comment for somebody to make. How in general have reviewers received your work, Rosalie?
You know, mostly positively. I think there's also, you know, and this one has gotten some good coverage too. So it's been exciting to see for sure. I think there's been a lot of really generous readers and a lot of people who've been generous with their time and have supported the book. So I've been very grateful for sure.
Well, your second book was actually won the Sue Grafton Memorial Award, right? And was a finalist for a Lambda Literary Award. The Lambda Literary Awards are, they are awarded in June. So they sync with Gay Pride Month. Although, you know, honestly, I can't remember, Rosalie, looking back, if that was always true. Do you remember? I mean, you know, I've been following them for forever, but I'm not entirely sure they were always in June.
I'm not sure either. Last year was the only one that I had, you know, attended, although it was virtually. So I can't be sure. I'm not sure if they were. I don't know how long June has been sort of the designated Pride Month, although now that I'm saying that, I think it may be because the Stonewall riots happened in June, but don't
forget. No, that was the rationale that I have seen, but I'm, as I say, I'm not at all clear. Seems to have some dim memory that they used to take place earlier in the spring, but I don't know. I've always been an admirer of Michael Nava, who was a mainstream gay writer for a long time. I mean, he, you know, just extraordinary work, I think. And he was always up for Lambda Awards. And there's an author from Minneapolis, Ellen something, I'm having a momentary blank here, who's probably written at least 30 or 35 books about a lesbian detective in the Twin Cities. And she's won all kinds of awards. But the Lambda Awards are not crime, just crime. I mean, there's a whole ton of categories, right?
Yeah, yeah.
It's, Ellen Hart, thank you, Patrick. Right, Ellen Hart, who's, I think she might even be an MWA Grandmaster now that I think about it. But anyway, the Lambda Awards are awarded for all kinds of categories. So, you know, it's a really neat deal. So wonderful for you that that your book received that much recognition from two very different award tiers.
Yeah, yeah, it's been a wonderful ride.
So before we talk about Vera Kelly, Lost and Found, you've written some other works. So, you know, not just crime. Or not only crime, I shouldn't say just. What is your other literary output been?
Well, my first book was called Relief Map, which is kind of a coming of age story, which came out in 2016. And then I also had a translation of an Argentine writer whose name is Cesar Ayra, who's gotten some more attention. My translation of him came out in 2011, and he's gotten some more attention since then. There's some really great translations out there of his work. He's written a million books. Chris Andrews has translated a couple of them, I think, at this point. He's really great. And some other people have put out books of his. New Directions puts out his books in the US. So that's the other piece that I got to do, which was great.
So what attracted you to the mystery novel or the crime novel? Because I think that's a more embracing term.
I honestly did not expect to be taken seriously I kind of think it was just noir. I did not expect to take seriously as a noir writer. I sort of was like, I'm going to sort of write something that sounds and feels like noir, which is silly, of course. I can't actually write a noir. And it was just surprising that if you just are like, here's a noir novel, people say, okay, like it's a noir novel. I'm not sure what I was expecting. So I didn't exactly set out to do that. I sort of was like, oh, you know, I'd like to write about, you know, my mom grew up in Chevy Chase, Maryland. Her dad worked for the CIA. Her mom was, her mother was a journalist. And this was, you know, my grandmother was born in 1922. So she had this like very sort of serious career as a journalist and an editor through the 50s and 60s, which is pretty unusual for a woman at the time. And I was kind of intrigued by both of them and by that milieu, just like the buttoned up inner ring DC suburbs, right? Which are very much entwined with the government, obviously, and people who work for the federal government at that time. So I kind of started there with just sort of the idea of the character, this kind of like wayward teen, which, you know, I don't wanna be speaking out of school, but my mom was a bit of a wayward teen and I was kind of intrigued by that whole scenario.
You should be proud of her, come on. Actually, you know what? That's the food or the fodder for crime fiction is that you want wayward people. You should be rejoicing that your mom was a wayward teen, for heaven's sake.
I think she's watching, so I don't want to, you know,
sorry, mom. Okay.
But she, you know, she had gotten in trouble. She had some wild teen years, and I was, although she's actually, she is like sort of a half generation removed from Vera Kelly, but I was just interested in the idea of this character. Someone who's sort of like not able to fit in and is not able to kind of connect with the ethos of where she is and has these, the sort of the poles of these sort of two lives going on. And so it sort of, the idea, since I was thinking about the CIA and I was thinking about spies and it was the 50s, it's sort of like, it seemed like natural to write about that kind of, in that kind of noir style. We do like that.
So when Patrick, when I summon Patrick back up after we've talked about your book some, he's our noir specialist at the Poison Pen, and we've had many discussions about what is actually noir, what's noir versus hard-boiled, you know, noir always have a downward spiral so that, you know, can you have a happy noir?
That's a good question. That's a very good question. I think he's probably more qualified to answer that than I am. It's sort of a cozy noir at the end of the day. I think it's like ended up being a cozy noir.
It's usually a downward spiral, but you know, you two can talk about it. But why don't you tell us what Vera Carolee Lost and Found is about, and then we'll summon up Patrick to have a larger discussion.
For sure. So in Vera Carolee Lost and Found, she sort of started to figure out her personal life. And as the book opens, she's in her home with her girlfriend, and things are happy and calm. And of course, something must intrude. So what happens is that her girlfriend, Max, hears from her estranged family, which is a very wealthy family in California, in Los Angeles. She gets a letter from her sister saying that her parents have divorced, and that, their father's already planning to remarry someone much younger, and it's chaotic. And so she flies back home to kind of see what's happening, and Vera goes with her. And shortly after they get there and have kind of a confrontation with Max's estranged father, Max disappears. That's the setup.
So it's 1971 at this point now. We've moved forward some, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So basically it's a missing person case in a way, except that we're pretty sure that we know where she went missing, as opposed to a more random missing person case when somebody disappears from a park or something and you have absolutely no clue where they are. But of course, in 1971, we don't have any, Google or GPS coordinates or cell phones or any of that stuff. Is that one reason that you were drawn to writing historical, was that you didn't have to deal with all the modern technology?
I think it definitely has been helpful. It's like helpful, I think, for plot to have that there. I originally was interested, I think, in this time period because I was interested in the Cold War, so kind of flowed from there. But yeah, somebody was just pointing out, I did an in-person event last night, and Jane Peck, who was doing the, was having the chat with, was saying, yeah, I was realizing at one point that if she was able to just Google the name of this hospital, then like there'd be no story. And I was like, yeah, that's true.
Well, it is true. And in order to successfully kidnap somebody, I mean, you'd have to take them off the grid, you'd have to get their phone and whatever. There's a lot to consider. It's much more complex to write some old-fashioned plots. I mean, for example, the lost heir plot has been totally destroyed by DNA and genetic testing. It's not possible for Dickens to write Bleak House today. I mean, it just can't happen. So, literary forms have had to adapt as technology has changed the landscape. So you get to avoid all that by, Sue Grafton, whose award you won, made a decision to keep her series in the 1980s so that Kitsy, as a private eye, still had to do like real footwork and, get out on the street. She couldn't just, Google stuff or hack into police records or, put a transponder on a car or whatever, all the things that modern PIs can do. And so interestingly enough, by the time she got to Y, she was a very dear friend and I miss her greatly. We did so many events with her. But by the time she got towards the end of the alphabet, she was writing historical fiction, even though when she started out with AS for Alibi, it was in the 1980s and contemporary. So authors have had to make some real choices, but because you started back so early, even though you've moved forward, you haven't moved forward into a modern age. So there they are in California. Max's family is pretty dysfunctional.
Yeah, I sort of was modeling them on the big money California sinister family, Raymond Chandler kind of trope, and two, the Hearsts a little bit. It was... because I had visited the Hearst Castle and I was kind of intrigued by the whole history. So so it starts from there, and it's a pretty straightforward disappearance, and then we get to see Vera kind of working through her issues on the road.
I thought you did the Hearst Castle pretty well. I remember going to it on my first honeymoon in 1962. When I might add, you could just drive up to the door and stroll in. Tourism wasn't all that big a thing then, and it was a lot easier to have access to iconic places before there were so many people trying to batter their way in. And there's a there's a lot of stuff around the Hearst Castle. I mean, you know, potential murder and lots of scandal and, you know, enormous money. And I remember the baronial dining hall so well. I mean, you went in and you have this enormous Gothic hall and banners hanging down in the hall pit, but then outside you have basically a Roman swimming pool, you know, with marble and all. So Hearst was not consistent architecturally in the castle.
Yeah, but I loved that. I mean, and that's, and the like the bottles of ketchup on the long dining table in that room, you know, and the movie theater. It is just like, it's wonderful how it just feels extremely American, right? That someone was like, I have more money than God, and I'm gonna buy half of a French church, and I'm gonna cram it together with like a piece of a Roman villa, and I'm gonna have a bunch of movie stars here. I mean, it's like the most American thing I could possibly imagine, right?
Well, you're right. You know, I haven't really thought about that. And what a contrast it is to the cloisters, where, you know, Rockefeller decided that he would bring over pieces of religious buildings, you know, churches and so forth. But there was a lot more, I mean, there are different styles. He's got Romanesque and Gothic and all, but there's at least a consistency to, right, you know, to what he's doing. It's, for those of you who don't know, the cloisters, it's the medieval branch of the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and it's set up in Fort Tryon Park on a bluff overlooking the Hudson. So it's really very cool place to visit. But if you can't get to Europe, you can at least feel as though you've wandered through some major cities. But it's European, your point that the Hearst is an American kind of a thing. The Rockefeller thing was really, I think, bringing, you know, a sense of Europe to a place in America, but not making it super American.
Right.
I forgot about the ketchup. That's a really good point.
Yeah.
It takes an eye for detail to make a really good novelist. So clearly Rosalie does have that. So, well, we can't really talk about what happens, can we, without blowing the plot?
Not too much. But it's kind of a road novel. There's a lot of driving.
It is. It's,
I will say that. And it was March 2020 when I started writing this book. So it was definitely some sort of wish fulfillment happening there. I mean, it opens with like a house party and then there's like a long road trip. These were all things that I 100% had no access to. I was in, you know, being here in the New York area, which got hit really hard, really early, kind of lockdown, sort of, you know, a scary time. And I was, you know, trapped in my apartment with my my toddler and my husband. And it was, you know, we were spared the worst of it, but it was definitely not like going to a house party or a long road trip up the California coast. And there was a little bit of just wish fulfillment for me of just sort of like locking myself in the back room and like writing these scenes and feeling some relief.
Right, locking yourself away from the toddler, which I think would be a hard thing to do. And I hear a puppy pawing at my door. So we acquired, they turned one on Friday, but we acquired them when they were tiny, like 4 pounds each. Because we thought at our advanced age, I'm in my 80s, that it would be really fun to be like a new mom one more time, you know. And so clearly I couldn't do it with a baby, so we did it with puppies. And I'd forgotten how strenuous it is.
Yeah, I bet. I mean, right, they don't sleep. It's the same stuff. They don't sleep. They got to get up and pee all the time.
That's right. And on the floor if they're a puppy. So, totally forgotten about. We went through a lot of mops. Did extra laundry, which is the other thing I'd forgotten about. Your washing machine becomes your new best friend when you have a little one. And so what are you thinking of working on next? Is Vera going to continue, or are you gonna, you know, what's your current writing project?
This is the end for Vera, I think. And I mean, never say never, I guess, but this is the last one I'm planning to write. And I don't know what's next because I've been writing these books for 10 years. I mean, I've worked on all these things simultaneously here and there, and I have toyed around with a new project that I don't even know how to articulate what it's going on with it. But I think I sort of need like a reset of some kind. It's like, it's been a 10-year period, but I wrote these books and a lot happened, you know, my personal life. I got married, I had a couple of kids, there was a pandemic, I switched careers. Like, it feels like there's like a lot of, it's like if you shake up a snow globe, it's like I need to put the snow globe down, let the snow settle, and then see what kind of writer I am now.
Well, you know, a trilogy is certainly a time-honored form. of, you know, of a overall storytelling arc, a three-act drama. So if, you know, if your story is largely told in three acts, then, you know, why not move on?
Yeah, I think three is like a natural number, right? As soon as I thought I was going to write a second one, I thought, well, obviously there will be three total.
Right.
It just felt inevitable, you know.
Well, hardly anyone writes a quartet or, you know, except Lawrence Durrell. Yeah, I think there are an awful lot of trilogies out there. Does the crime fiction form appeal to you, or do you really feel like you'd like to move into something else?
I think I'll probably just go back to kind of straight literary fiction, which is what I was doing before, and see what I find there. That had been kind of my plan. You know, for as much as we know what that means exactly. That was my thought, yeah.
Well, I shouldn't press you on a point since, you know, obviously it's kind of up in the air. Let's call Patrick up and talk about noir fiction for a little bit, because that's always a fun topic to get into. Right. So, Patrick, here's Rosalie wanting to write a noir, but not apparently really knowing entirely what noir is. So maybe you could help her out here.
It's funny because I've been running a discussion group here at the bookstore for like 21 years. And we still don't know exactly what it is. We've been kicking around that concept, and everybody has a slightly different definition. But it's interesting because in your new book in California, one of the things that's so great about, you know, Raymond Chandler, of course, is that he somehow captured just the bizarreness of California so well, you know, and it's such a unique, strange place, you know, with I've always thought there was kind of an occult underbelly in LA, especially in Hollywood, you know, with that long history of cults and Amy Semple McPherson and Scientology, and it's just a bizarro landscape. It lends itself perfectly to the crime novel.
Yeah, I love that kind of, I mean, I got to write, you know, parts of the series in New York, which I feel like these are sort of the two styles, right, or two kind of dominant schools. Which has like a very different feeling from that kind of the sort of sinister sunshine kind of feeling of LA noir. And the Amy Semple McPherson, it sort of plays a role in this book. And I had read the great, great book, Going Clear, nonfiction about Scientology, about L. Ron Hubbard, which I really recommend to everyone. I think I've read it like three or four times. Like truth truly is stranger than fiction. And like as a portrait of kind of mid-century LA, I mean, I guess starting in the 40s, I think, like right after the war, through the 50s, it's like really incredible. Like sort of as just like a snapshot of that time. And some of the like, just the strains of like celebrity and cult behavior and just the ways that people kind of seem to lose their minds with just a little bit of pressure in a certain direction. It's really something. He was also, you know, he was, L. Ron Hubbard was kind of running in circles with Aleister Crowley, right?
That's right.
Which was a little bit of the inspiration for one of the characters in the book too.
Writing pulp stories.
Right.
You know, which is really interesting. All these different things kind of, you know, threading together, and of course Hollywood was thick with Germans, you know, before the war. You know, all those the filmmakers, and you know, you think of Fritz Lang and all these interesting characters that are sort of, imagine being at a Hollywood cocktail party in the 30s in California, and who you might meet. And Elroy writes about that really well. You know, he manages to capture a lot of the strange currents that are coming together.
But there are a huge number of people who were in California to, you know, self-invention or reinvention. You know, I mean, we didn't start out with a big native population. You know, it was people who came, I mean, the movie industry came there from New Jersey. Edison was such a pain in the ass in New Jersey and so monopolistic that, you know, people went to California, partly also because the climate meant they could make movies without sound stages. Sound stages didn't come along until there was sound. So, you know, you had all these invented lives, invented stories, people you know, making themselves over. So I think
extra interesting too to think about Rosalie, Hollywood in California in 71. You know, here you are 50 years into really the motion picture industry. You know, it started out in the late teens and 20s, right? Was it fun to kind of go in there and do a little bit of research about what it was like in 71? It's very different than what it was like in the 40s. You know, you think
And you know, what I actually, where I went to do that hardcore historical research was that I listened to Angelica Houston's memoir on audiobook, because also I was wrangling a toddler. So I was like listening to this, like, she has this wonderful voice, you know, and I was listening to her like describe going to parties with Jack Nicholson and stuff like that. And that was actually really helpful. I feel like I got a little bit of a grasp of like the feel of things from Angelica Houston's memoir and from Jean Stein's book about, which I feel like I'm going to mangle the title of. Is it called West of Eden? Something like that. But Jean Stein, it came from this, you know, kind of California royalty sort of family too. I think it was oil money that Steins had. And so she wrote this also wonderful book, which I think is called West of Eden. Eden is in the name. That was an oral history of kind of 40s, 50s, 60s Hollywood, which was also really terrific.
West of Eden, right? There it is.
Yes.
So great, that's a good book. Is it? Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you happen to see, I know it's a recreation of that era, but did you happen to see the Quentin Tarantino's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood?
Haven't, but I think it would be right up my alley, I imagine.
1969. And it's all, you know, about the kind of the last years of the Western stars and all these kind of washed up and all the television and just debauchery and, you know, the Manson family and all these different currents coming together. You know, the sort of late 60s burnout, idealism of the flower power era turning into 70s, you know, drug addiction and burnout. So 71, really fascinating time period.
And too much money washing around, for sure.
Yeah.
So Patrick, back to my question that I asked Rosalie, you know, when we're talking about noir fiction, is it always going to be a downward spiral? Is it possible to have a happy noir?
It doesn't seem like it really is, does it? It turns into something else, which can be very interesting too. But I don't know. I mean, I might be wrong about that. I mean, there are certainly some good noir spoofs that have come out.
But they're spoofs. I mean, I think that that's intentional going in.
Yeah.
But
you know, I think I sort of ran into a problem there, because when I was writing the first book, at the end of the first book, or in my original draft, Vera sort of at the very end, she sort of quickly in summary, she talks about having like getting together with this woman and having like a brief, you know, kind of relationship with this woman and then being left. So she ends the book sort of alone, like alone in her house. And kind of heartbroken. And a friend in my writing group said, "You can't give me another sad, heartbroken lesbian who ends up alone." She was like, "There is a history of this thing of like representing queer characters, but only if they get punished, if they end up alone or dead or, you know, left for somebody else." And she was like, "I just don't want you to end with her that way." And I felt like, but that's tricky because this is kind of a noir and you're not supposed to end up like happily partnered at the end of the noir. So what I ended up doing was I was like, okay, so she can go through the heartbreak, but I'm going to kick it from the end of the first book to the beginning of the second, because it's completely different to get dumped at the beginning of a book than at the end of a book. So that's what I did. And it was sort of an interesting moment where like two currents in literature like created problems for each other, where sort of the classic like lonely dysfunctional alcoholic protagonist, you know, who's got a string of divorces or whatever, kind of collided with this like the sense I think that a lot of readers have, that like if you're going to give me a queer character, I don't want to see them punished, and I don't want to see them alone, I don't want to see them be a romantic failure.
But then a lot of people can relate to the romantic failure.
Well, that's really true. So I put it in there anyway. I just moved it around, you know, so that it could be resolved. So
I was going to ask you, it's funny, what we brought up Patricia Highsmith with another author recently, but she's one of my all-time favorites. Very slippery, interesting character. Did you happen to, are you familiar with her books? There was a great memoir she wrote, or this lady named Mary Jane Meeker wrote about a year in New York with Patricia Highsmith. Great portrait of the city. It was a little bit before this time, but it might have been more for your earlier two books about the art scene and, you know, the realities of, you know, lesbian relationship in New York and all that kind of stuff.
That sounds amazing. Actually, I wish.
Yeah, Mary Jane Meeker is her name. She wrote as Vin Packer, wrote, you know, lesbian kind of crime stuff for Gold Medal.
No, that was Vin Packer.
Vin Packer. Yeah, Mary Jane Meeker.
Oh.
She was in a relationship with Highsmith very briefly during that time period.
There were a lot of very brief relationships with Highsmith. So.
She was
a real piece of work.
Total piece of work. Yeah. Yeah.
She really was. Yeah. But, you know, I don't know whether in today's context she could have had a happier life or not. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether the possibility of, you know, being out, of possibility of being married. We had an event last night where the husband of the male author, you know, came to the event and you know, nobody thought anything except that was really nice. And, you know, that would have been possible at the time you were writing. So I don't know whether, you know, some of those characters today would be written differently.
Yeah. I mean, it is, that's sort of the, like, that's kind of the thing hanging over a lot of it, you know, is a sense of like, how could things have been different?
That's a tricky question, because I imagine you, you know, having that, not letting a modern mindset or a modern sensibility creep into these period pieces, that's probably very tricky, because I imagine it would in very subtle ways without realizing it, maybe.
Yeah, there were, I think, some moments where, actually there was a really great example of this, and I have to again give credit to my friend in my writing group who's gay and who also, you know, grew up in LA in the 70s and 80s and had like a little bit of, you know, just perspective to share with me on a lot of the stuff. In an earlier draft of the third book, I had Max and Vera exchange rings, and just, you know, privately, but I had to do that. And my friend said, I've been thinking about this and it does not feel right to me. She said, the reason is that I think that a woman at that time who was gay would not want to be wearing a wedding band out in public, because she would constantly be assumed to be straight, because there was no context really for like an actual, you know, same-sex marriage with rings and the whole thing. I mean, not that no one ever did that, right? Of course, people have always done that in different ways, but like, it would be something that she would anticipate would make people sort of constantly refer to her as Mrs. and this whole thing. And that would feel, it would clash for her with her sense of herself. And I thought that was a really great example of something that, because like, you know, most of my adult life has happened in a you know, world where same-sex marriage was legal in a lot of states and then nationwide. To me, like, sort of, the sense of there being like just an sort of an alienness about the whole idea of wearing a ring and referring to yourself that way, it wasn't immediately obvious to me. When she explained it, I was like, yeah, of course, that makes sense. So I changed it. I took it out. But yeah, I think that was sort of the kind of just like a wrong note. You know what I mean? Like, looking backwards, like, it would have sounded a false note, and I had to kind of not just do some research, but also make sure that I was like talking to people who knew more about it than I did. So that I could avoid sounding those false notes.
Were there any, you know, sort of other models just for the series in general? Not directly, but just sources of inspiration among your peers? I mean, there's some great writers. Like, I think of Amy Stewart, who's doing that Miss Cop series. Of course, Sarah Grand, who's incredible. Any other inspirations?
Yeah, I mean, I love them both. They're both terrific writers. And I think I also, just even when I was younger, was sort of, there was like a moment in time, I feel like, in kind of the early aughts, when there was like a lot of experimentation happening with genre tropes, you know, like Michael Chabon was like writing, you know, The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, and Jonathan Lapham was right. You know, it was like this thing of like sort of playing around with these like pulpy concepts and tropes and all that stuff. So that was also sort of in the back of my mind, just that moment of experimentation and play with that kind of stuff. Although I don't think my book did not end up being sort of in that vein, really. But I think that's what made it feel accessible, and like those things were kind of interesting to remix and play around with.
In this current era where there is such a pressure for an author to be authentic, you know, that for you as a mom and married woman to be writing about a gay character gets increasingly difficult. I was really disturbed, although fascinated, to read an article from the UK and I think the bookseller yesterday about sensitivity readers who've been hired by publishers. This is more in YA, but young adult fiction, but could be more broadly spoken. And their object is to read books and make sure that underrepresented voices or inauthentic experiences are weeded out, so to speak. So, you know, it's hard if you're not a person of color to write about a character who is at the moment. And it's probably difficult for a person to write gay fiction if you're not. And I'm appalled by this because I think fiction is fiction and that people should be able to use their imagination to write whatever they want. But it's a tricky era all of a sudden at the moment. And it's interesting to me that society is freer in some ways than publishing, because you know, you like to think that ideas are the freest thing of all, but you know, and it's really not. I mean, I think it's fear. I think it's fear of Twitter mobs. I think it's fear of, you know, this rise in book banning and cancellations and so forth are making people very cautious. But I sort of feel like we've dropped back to Savonarola's Florence, or, you know, maybe we're in Munich before the putsch and, you know, there's the famous book burning night or something. It's a very strange time.
Yeah, I mean, I think that sensitivity readers, it's interesting because I feel like I have thought about that a lot and I have worried about it, to be honest. Just like I've worried, like, if I'm going to represent an experience that I don't have a personal claim to, I feel like just the responsibility to like do it accurately and respectfully is just a lot higher. And I think, you know, for me, that had to do with just like trying to do my research as best as I could, and also just like talking to friends, you know, who had more experience than I did, and getting like beta readers in that way. And like even that process where my friend was like, this doesn't really feel right. You know, like it just sort of, not that it's offensive, but it just feels off. It just feels like sort of a misreading, and being able to like have that feedback was super, super helpful. And I think sensitivity readers is sort of a way of institutionalizing it. If you don't maybe have access to like a reader who like has the experience to speak to you on that in your personal life, sort of an effort to just like avoid misrepresenting people who have to fight for representation anyway. But yeah, I think there's always, you know, there is certainly this potential with Twitter and a lot of platforms for stuff to be taken out of context and also read in the worst possible faith. And I think that can be really frustrating. But yeah, I mean, I think if I had set out to do it, I'm not sure I would have. It sort of developed in the process of writing the book. And I think I probably wouldn't have sat down and thought, I'm gonna write about a gay character, you know? But she sort of like became gay through many drafts and I went with it. But yeah, it is like, I do think people's expectations and people's sense of responsibility has shifted pretty rapidly.
I think about, for example, The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime is a really terrific book. I'm trying to remember who wrote it, but a marvelous book. And you know, it's about a neurodivergent child. And so, you know, are we going to argue today that if you're not a neurodivergent child, you couldn't have written a book about a neurodivergent child called The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime? I mean, what lengths are we taking this to? I find it, as I say, really, really disturbing.
And it creates a unique problem for fiction, I think, which is really interesting, right? Like it's because yeah, it sort of does always raise the question of like, you know, when you're talking about identity categories, it can feel fairly straightforward. But when you're getting more broadly into the question as just sort of representing experiences that you haven't had, you know, it becomes really kind of a complex literary conversation, I feel like.
It seems like the book should be judged on its own merits. You know, if it's not a convincing book, then so be it. You know, let it fail on those merits, you know, or lack thereof.
I agree.
There is this new almost conservative rigidity creeping into, you know, even but despite people's best intentions, it's kind of, in some ways, I think it's backfiring, you know, and it's putting a stranglehold on creativity in some ways, you know.
Well, I think social media, you know, while it has helped call attention to books and sell books and so forth, I think also has become a real instrument of censorship because people pile in. And we had an experience with another author was determined to cancel. I won't even go into it. And I remember my husband saying to me, you know, that most of the people that are piling onto this don't have any idea who's involved. They just want to be part of a cause, or they want to, you know, touch being famous, or they just want to be part of a mob. And I think that's one of the dangers too, is that there's not necessarily any careful consideration in the people who decide to leap in and try to cancel things. So I think it's a very dangerous time that, you know, that we're looking at for literature. And I hope it isn't going to be stifled so that, you know, we won't get Winnie the Pooh or, you know, The Wind in the Willows. Did you have to actually be, you know, badger living under whatever it is to write the book? I mean, how far do we want to take this?
It's tough. And I think there's also, you know, at the same time, there's like an actual effort to ban books from school curriculums for having LGBTQ content or for having, you know, content about, you know, accurate content about American history with slavery and things like that. So there's sort of this, you know, there's this like actual effort to, like, you know, literally taking books out of libraries on that side too, which is interesting. I mean, there's like a weird tension built into it where often the kind of the voices who are trying to take stuff out of school curriculums are also, you know, very critical of Twitter as if they have the same level of power, which of course they don't. I'm not going to defend Twitter. Twitter is a cesspool that I've recently attempted to get myself unaddicted to. But yeah, it is a very weird moment, right? There's this broad sense that censorship is happening, but people have really polarized concepts of who is censoring what and what we mean by censorship, right? From, like, on the one side, what is basically social pressure on the internet versus, like, these sort of whipped up mobs of organized parents who were yelling about trying to teach children about segregation. It's like, it's a really wild moment right now, I feel like.
I think so too. I'm, you know, we have to navigate it as a bookstore. You have to navigate it as an author. And, you know, I think it's a testing time for all of us. I'm a child of the 50s. I mean, I was a teenager, junior high school and teenager in the 50s during the McCarthy era. And I can only too clearly remember what the blacklist was like and the kind of pressures that created. And I feel like we're back there again. And,
I love it when this shit backfires though, like with the mouse books, you know, try to ban those and they become instant bestsellers, which I think.
Well, I think it does. Rosalie and I were talking earlier about, you know, prohibition actually, you know, created many evils that it was never intended to do. Right. And I think anytime you get a repression or an attempt to, you know, to modify people's behavior, strange things happen that you're not prepared for. But we digress from the literary here. So, Patrick, are there any questions that people might have introduced before we sign off?
Yeah, let's see here. Just a question about your publisher, Tin House, your wonderful literary small press. They do all kinds of interesting work. How's it been being published by Tin House?
They are the best. They're just the greatest. It's, you know, I think often it feels like the brass ring is like a big five publisher, but I feel like there's always the potential to get kind of like lost in the shuffle or forgotten. And I did, like, don't tell them I said that, but I, you know, I feel like I hear so many stories of kind of authors who get acquired and then kind of left behind. And Tin House is just like, they're so committed to every single title on their list. It's been just really,
it's
really
very personal. Having yeah. a smaller house like that, you know, you get much more attention, and they tend to let you do what you want to do more easily. So no, it's a very prestigious house. I meant to point that out. And clearly they have terrific graphic artists, because otherwise they wouldn't have this amazing cover. Right. I love it.
He just left, actually, sadly, but he's still going to have to do the third book, which I've got on to.
Goes to him. So Patrick, anything else?
Let's see. Have you had any nibbles from Hollywood or TV land yet for the series?
I did. I had some with the first book that was, it was optioned. And of course, an option means that they have the option to make something if they want. And that's, you know, they option a lot more stuff than they make. But I was happy to get that check. And nothing ever came of it, but I considered it a success. And they even renewed it. So I got paid twice. So by a subsidiary of a subsidiary of the Disney Corporation. So anytime you can get a little money out of the mouse's pocket,
yeah. How about foreign sales? Anything? The French seems like they would love it. Anybody?
They know. There's a Korean translation. There's a UK edition and there's a Korean translation out there, which I have a bunch of copies of, which was like really thrilling. There's like a small feminist press in Korea that did a translation.
Is there a Koreatown in your area? Have you thought about leaving them like anonymous copies and Korean restaurants would be kind
not of sure what to do with them. I live in Jersey City and I actually don't think we have a Koreatown.
Make a trek into the city with a bag of books.
Yeah.
we were asking about names. You know, names are very important. Was Vera Kelly always Vera Kelly? And I mean, the Vera is such a classic. You know, you think of that from the, you know, golden age of Hollywood. Where did the name come from, and the names in general in the book?
You know, Vera, like the first time around, her name was, and it just like kind of popped into my head all together. It was Vera Torrance King. I don't know why. I'm not sure where that traces to, but that was the name that came to me. And then I changed it at some point to Vera Kelly. It seemed simpler. And my publisher liked the name. That's why they ended up, they titled the book. They didn't title them. They were like, let's do something with the name. You know, let's just think with the name. So I'm not sure. It was just a little bit of like kismet or something. And then a funny thing was that with the first book, as it was going out, somewhere in the chain of, you know, people getting promotional materials and people are sort of connected or tangentially connected to Tin House or to publishing, there was a woman who was like, my 13-year-old daughter's name is Vera Kelly. So we sent her a poster. But there is at least one real Vera Kelly out there, probably more.
That's cool.
Yeah.
No other real questions have come in. So
in that case, let us thank Rosalie for spending an hour with us. And let me remind you that not only do we have copies of Vera Kelly Lost and Found, but we have book plates. And if you want to read the whole series, you can do that too. And we still have book plates, so it'll all work out. But anyway, it's a great trilogy. And I think a lot of, I could recommend that you read the entire thing rather than just a single book. But thank you very much, Rosalie.
Thank you so much for your time.
And also for writing these wonderful books. And good night.
Thank you.
Bye, everybody. Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.